Okay, so let me remind you what we're looking at this sort of equation. Some Dirichlet boundary condition, and from everything is smooth. And it's an elliptic equation. Everything's smooth. Holmberg is a bounded domain, and from last time, assume we've already bounded U and its first and second derivatives, okay? And from last time, I described Krylov's boundary gradient estimate, and my application of that was that for this problem you have an estimate for the Hölder seminorm of the second derivatives on the boundary, so for all x and y on the boundary. Okay, where c and alpha controlled constants. So depending on things like the ellipticity and on bounds on the function u and its first and second derivatives and on the domain and the boundary data. Okay, so today I want to extend this to a global estimate. So, the main result that allows you to do that is the very famous Evans-Krylov estimate, which is why Craig should be giving this lecture, of course. And it says the following, that okay, so maybe let me state the assumptions. So I said F is smooth. Everything is smooth. I won't state that. We've got ellipticity. And then we've got concavity. That's the other assumption we need today. F is concave. And another way to write that is if you take the partial derivatives of F with respect to the second derivative variables, that should be less than or equal to zero for all symmetric matrices. Eta. Okay, and this Evans-Krylov estimate says the following. It can be stated in various ways, but for every compactly contained subdomain in omega, there exists controlled constants C positive alpha between 0 and 1, such that for any omega prime compactly contained in omega, we have, okay, the sup of x and y in omega prime is bounded by some controlled constant C over the distance to the boundary and power alpha. Okay, that's what it says. That's one way of stating. Okay, and this result is really very important in fully nonlinear PDE. It was really a big breakthrough because before that there were really only very specialized techniques that were available. So basically, there were results for the Monge-Ampère equation, which used some computations of Calabi to estimate higher derivatives, third derivatives. So this was a big breakthrough. Okay, so the proof I'm going to describe of this is the one that's in Gilbert and Schrödinger, and I'm not sure how close that is to the original, to your proof, Craig. Is it close or? Okay. I read your paper many years ago, and I've forgotten now how it goes. Okay, so you start off by differentiating the equation. In PDE, if you don't know how to do anything else, that's the first thing you try. You differentiate. So here, gamma is a unit vector in Rn. Right. So that's what it implies. No. You have this on compact subdomains, and the constant blows up as you go out to the boundary, right? There's going to be an intermediate step where you combine that with a barrier argument and some other stuff to get. An estimate like this. For all x in omega y on the boundary. Okay? So first I'm going to prove this. Then I'm going to show how you get that from that. And then once you get that, then you can combine these two to get it's going to be a new constant. It's going to be a new alpha for all x and y in omega. Okay, it's going to be, say, alpha over 2. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do. So this is the main part. The rest is... Yes, they're all... This alpha is a different alpha, but I mean, it doesn't matter. You at the end, you care that you get some alpha. It doesn't matter. If you work through the proof and see what it depends on, it's, you know, some tiny, tiny alpha. But it doesn't matter. Okay, so you differentiate once. And since we want to do something with the second derivatives, it's good to have an equation for the second derivatives. So you differentiate again. D gamma gamma G, and this part we know by concavity that's less than or equal to 0, so we just throw that away. Okay, now we let, so what we've got is Fij Dij gamma gamma U is bigger than or equal to D gamma gamma G for all gamma. Okay, so, and this is uniform really. Okay, so we can't apply the Harnack inequality, but we can apply the weak Harnack inequality. So we take two balls, concentric balls, in omega, and we let, for say F equal 1 and 2, we let NF equal the soup. So I'll call W, save a little bit of writing. So B, F, R, so F is 1 or 2, W, and little m, F is the in. And then the weak Harnack inequality. Okay, I have to apply it to the right thing. Apply it to M2 minus W in the ball B2R implies that less than the inf of the same thing, so a constant times the inf of plus the correction term you get, which is just an r squared. It's actually r squared times the sup of this thing. Oh, I won't worry about it. I'll just absorb that into the constant. If you want to be more careful about what the constants depend on, then you should stick it in here, but it's not really important. Okay, and this is over the ball BR, so we can estimate that. It's the inf, so we get M2 minus M1. Okay? Okay, now, because we've got an inequality, we can't use the full Harnack inequality where we would have soup here, so we have to do some extra work to get an estimate, right? This isn't going to give us all the continuity just by itself. Okay, so the extra work comes in now. So first of all, concavity of S again. So let me just write it out. So F D2U at X is F of D2U at Y plus Fij at D2U Y times DijU at X minus Diju at y, and then there would be another term, which would be second derivatives of f and something quadratic in second derivatives here, and we throw that away using concavity again, so we get less than or equal to. Now you rearrange that. So rearrange this so it looks closer to what we want. Less than or equal to now. Which is g at y minus g at x, which is less than a constant times x minus y. And basically what this is going to allow us to do is to get an estimate for W minus M, little m1 or m2. Okay, so now the problem we have now is what we have here. See, this is summed over I and j. What we have here is we don't have pure second derivatives, right? And things would be nice if we knew that this was a diagonal matrix. But you can't assume it's diagonal everywhere, right? You can diagonalize it at one point. Okay, so then there's this important lemma which tells you basically you can treat this as a diagonal matrix. Okay, and precise statement is like this: let S lambda, capital lambda, denote the set of positive, so symmetric matrices, so positive matrices in, say, S, N cross N, so symmetric, with eigenvalues lying in lambda, capital lambda, where these are two positive numbers. Then there is a finite set of unit vectors, gamma 1 up to gamma n, some large number n, but it's controlled. And these are in R n, and positive numbers lambda star . All these things depend only on n lambda, little lambda, such that any matrix A which belongs to positive definite eigenvalues between lambda and capital lambda can be written as A is a sum of these dyadic things. So you take these rank 1 matrices formed from these things, and you take a linear combination of those, where these betas belong to lambda star up to capital lambda. Okay, and furthermore, this set gamma 1 up to gamma n can be chosen to include the standard basis vectors E1 up to En and Ei plus Ej over square root of plus or minus with, say, I less than j. Okay, so that's a little bit much to take in all at once. What it says is, basically, if you control the eigenvalues of a positive matrix between two constants, then you can write it in this way, with a uniform choice of vectors, gamma, and with coefficients which stay in a bounded, controlled, bounded interval. And the point is, it doesn't matter. You can do this uniformly for all matrices. So this is important for the application because, you know, we don't want to diagonalize this just at one point. We want to be able to choose these gamma so it works everywhere. So this is sort of like diagonalizing a matrix sort of everywhere with, in effect. Okay, I'll skip the proof of that for now. I'll come back to it at the end. At least if I will, if I have time. So now we set M SK equal to the sup WK over BSR. Little M SK is the inf BSR WK. WK is D gamma K gamma KU. Well, the proof is basically like this. Any positive definite matrix can be written is similar to a thing like this, right? It's a positive definite matrix. You can rotate it to make it diagonal, and then you can stretch. So it looks like the identity. So any two matrices, positive definite matrices, with eigenvalues bounded here, look are similar to the identity, right? And then you choose. Then this set here is compact, right? So if you look at the set of all, basically if you look at the set of all combinations like this, where these are linearly independent and the betas are positive, that's an open cover of this compact set. And so you choose a finite cover from that. And that's where the N comes from. And then there's a little bit more fiddling to make sure that you can bound the beta from below and throw in these extra things. It comes from a compactness argument. So you don't have any control over what this N is. It could be astronomical, right? But it doesn't matter. There is an N. Okay, so now we apply what we had up here. So maybe I'll just write it here. Here I applied this for any W here, but now in particular I apply it to WK. So let me put in some Ks. Okay. Right, like this. Okay, and now so let's call that star. So that's K not equal to L. I fix some L, and I sum over K not equal to L, and I write out what I get. Okay, so first of all, let me do the steps so it's a little bit clearer. Now the P here, remember the P in the Harnack inequality could be less than 1. In fact, typically it's a very small P, right? So you have to keep in mind that when you
do the estimates that you really should assume p is between 0 and 1. Okay, so now you use the fact that, let me write it out. So this uses the fact that the balls in little LP, let me draw a picture. Here's the L1 ball. L infinity ball is like that. The L2 balls around one. And for P between 0 and 1, the LP balls are sort of like this. Right? So, okay, so, and that's how you get from here to here, using the fact that the L1 norm of this sort of vector of length n minus 1 is less than or equal to the little lp length. Right? And then you use Hölder's inequality in little LQ, with Q equal to 1 over P, which is bigger than 1. So you get a factor 1 over N to the 1 over P out the front. And then what have we got? This, which is less than or equal to, this is just a constant, using this estimate here for each k. Okay. Which is less than or equal to a constant times omega 2r minus omega r plus r squared, where SR is equal to the sum, the oscillation of over BSR of W. Okay. Okay, now we come back to here. Okay, we're going to use this lemma with this as our choice of matrix A. Okay, so we're going to express the left-hand side here as a sum of things like that. So we have beta L, this is at the point Y, W L Y minus W L X, less than
well, this will just be constant x minus y plus, so we take the term we get with L here, and all the other stuff we put on the other side. All at y. Okay, so now it's x minus wk at y. Right? We estimate this. This is bounded by a constant. We can just absorb it into there. And this is n2k minus wky. So now we're taking, say, y to be any point in br and x to be in b2r. And this is bounded from below by this constant lambda star. So now if we integrate this, and estimate this, we can estimate WL by the nth. Since it says a minus sign, we can choose x to be any point we want. We may as well put evaluate it at the nth. It's still okay. And we integrate. And what we get is a constant. Constant's already there. We get an r plus with a little bit of algebra. Know from up the top here, this part here we can estimate by this. It's less than or equal to a constant. We get omega 2r minus omega r plus r plus r squared. Okay. Now we look at this. And this part here. Okay, if the p's were 1, it's completely obvious that you just add these two together and you get m2k minus little m2l. You look at this with k equal to L, and if the p's are there, well, you just get a constant, it doesn't really matter. If you add that to that, this is with k equal to L, where can I write this? So, add double star with k equal to L, to triple star to get uh, m 2l minus little m 2l is less than constant omega 2r minus omega r plus r plus r squared. Okay, and then we just sum over all l's. That just multiplies the constant by another constant, which doesn't matter. So what have we got then? This is omega 2r is less than or equal to what we have here. And when you stare at that for a while, you bring the omega r to the other side, is less than or equal to, it comes with a factor c, and then here we take that to the other side, we get c minus 1 omega 2r plus r plus r squared, and then we divide by the c, and this number here, let's call that gamma, this is less than 1, right? And that's Holder continuity, as I explained in the last lecture. You can plug into the DiGiorgi lemma, and you get omega r is less than or equal to r over r0. This is a constant alpha omega r0 plus let me just put a constant, it doesn't really matter. Okay, but you get this sort of decay for some alpha. Okay, so let's hold the continuity. Okay, so that's what it looks like on a ball. And now to get this result, right, the domain, the subdomain is a certain distance away, you simply apply that estimate on small enough balls so you keep away, and you just cover the whole domain. You do sort of a chaining argument, and you get this. And you get 1 over distance to that power, basically, because the R0 is in here. Right? Okay, so that's proved. So any questions? I've used the concavity in a couple of spots. I've used it once to throw away this bad term. And then I've used it again here to turn this around and get an estimate from the other side. You can only get a one-sided estimate just from the inequality. And concavity gets used again here to turn things around. Everything is smooth, so this is, I mean, if you want, you can put the DG, the soup norm of DG there, if you want. It's just, everything's just controlled. So I haven't been particularly careful about the constants. Yes?
Second derivative is a substitution.
Yes.
Okay, timeline, you have one state of control on all the circumstances. But you need two states of control. The final piece of information is that there's a functional relation between them, namely f of parentheses u x1 x1 so forth equals to 0. That means any one of them is a decreasing function of the other, and that can be the other side. And that's the heuristic.
Yeah.
Okay, so the trick here is we can reduce this case to only pure section of the case. And then push for L of the so, in this case, we can start a note where choose that each packet is decreasing. That's fine. That's not sure. But, so the argument I give is actually different from the abilities we can have it twice.
Yes.
So my argument doesn't use that. That's way more complicated. That's much more complicated to get it out. But again, the heuristic is each pure second derivative is a sub-solution, but there's the PDE itself is a functional relationship among them, saying that each one is a decreasing function of the other as well. Hence, the one side of control on the other is convincing that control. And you go, well, that's the other side. And the other side. Well, in this notation, you see, right hand column on the top, you chose one of them L, and you're doing all this stuff with the other.
Yes.
And this is a form of getting from the PDE the functional relationship that you can solve for even one of them. In this case, you differentiate twice, and again, the L selection kind of returns you the other. And it's more elegant than you have the thing called star.
Okay, so any more questions? No? Okay, now we've got this part now. Now I'll show how you get that and that. And then sometime we'll have a break maybe, and then I'll maybe go through this proof again. Well, no, I haven't.
So you get the.
But. Well, no. I haven't really used it. Here. Well, it does enter into the proof eventually because. Where's it gone? When you eventually get down to here, this is the oscillation over the second derivatives, and so eventually you have to estimate that. So, yeah. Yeah. So it does enter it eventually, but it hasn't been used before that. But in typical examples, let's say if you start, say, a Monge-Ampère equation, the ellipticity bounds depend on this. Right. Yes, under this concavity assumption. Well, I haven't explained that. It's separate arguments which I haven't gone through yet. Yes. Well, that depends more on the type of equation. This argument here really doesn't depend on what the equation was to begin with. As long as, once you've bounded the second derivatives, it's uniformly elliptic, and as long as it's concave, you can do all this. But you can do the same, you can modify the proof to work even if you have a more complicated equation. As long as you've got concavity and uniform ellipticity, it's just much more technical. That's why I don't want to do it in that situation.
generality. It's too technical.
But you can read about it. Yeah, that depends on the type of equation you have. So how you do that. Maybe to sort of, well, I guess I can clarify what we've got. So what I've got, you've got this estimate up to here, you get this Holder estimate, provided it's uniformly elliptic and concave, and you've bounded up to the second derivatives. But how you bound up to the second derivatives, that's not part of this story. Right? That depends on each equation. It can be a little different. There are certain similarities. It's always, you know, gradient estimates and second derivative estimates on the boundary come from sort of barrier constructions, and then to estimate the gradient inside in terms of the boundary, some sort of maximum principle for the gradient, and so on. There's certain similarities, but the technicalities depend on the particular equation. Okay, so now I want to explain how you go to here. So we assume we've got this estimate up here. We know that from last week. And I want to explain how you go to there. So first of all, we have a lemma. And the lemma is very... So let omega be a bounded domain with C2 boundary, and U is a function which is continuous on the bound up to on the closure C2 inside, a solution of Aij, let's call it L of U S, where it's uniformly elliptic F is bounded. What else? U equals phi on boundary, where phi is in C0 alpha. Okay? So that's what we have. I should call this W. W. Okay, so what am I going to apply it to? I'm going to apply it to W is D gamma gamma U. Right? And I know that is held a continuous boundary. And I know it satisfies a uniformly elliptic differential inequality. So that's what I'm going to apply the lemma to. And the lemma says that, so I can just get it the right way around, then for all x in omega and x0 on the boundary, wx minus wx0 is bounded by this constant times x minus x0 to the alpha. So basically you've got a differential inequality, you've got C alpha boundary data, you get one-sided control. And the constant depends on all the data. Okay, so the idea, so here's the domain. It least B2, so at any point you can find a ball outside. Let's call this B, so this can be, say, x0, this is BR, say, y, and you look at a barrier function like this. B of x is some k, so let's say this is x0, this is the origin, convenience. You look at, let's say, w at 0, also 0. You look at a barrier like this, k mod x to the alpha plus a times distance to the alpha, where d is the distance from x to the boundary of the ball. Okay? Then you compute. Then you compute. Well, I won't do the computation, I'll just state what you get. Then L of W, L of V is less than or equal to L of W in some epsilon neighborhood like this, such that D is less than epsilon, so that's in a little set like this. And B is bigger than or equal to W on the boundary of this neighborhood, provided you choose epsilon and K and A appropriately. So the choices that work are provided epsilon is between 0 and r over 2 satisfies, where is it? 2 alpha capital lambda n minus 1 epsilon over r is less than or equal to alpha 1 minus alpha lambda over 4. And a is so large that alpha k times the trace over A is less than or equal to alpha 1 minus alpha lambda over 4, and A epsilon alpha is bigger than the sup of W. I forgot to say what K is. K is just the alpha seminorm of the boundary. Okay, so I've given you the barrier, and I've told you what you have to do, and now you can do the computation and check. I'll leave there. Okay? So once you get this, therefore, by the comparison principle, V is bigger than W in this neighborhood. And that gives you what you want. Okay, so what we've got now, lemma implies that d gamma gamma u x minus d gamma gamma u x0 is bounded by bar x minus x0 for all
x in omega, x0 on the boundary.
And now to turn it around, we use concavity again, and this lemma here. You write, if you look in the second line from the top there, what you've got is, when you use this lemma here, you apply that with gamma equal to, with gamma k's, so you get beta k x0 d gamma k u x0 minus d gamma k u x less than or equal to constant x minus x0. And now you see you've got one-sided bound here and you've got this relation. You can, for any particular one, d gamma l lu x 0 minus d gamma l lu x is less than constant x minus x 0 plus constant sum right, k not equal to l, and these things you can control. The whole thing is less than some constant x minus x0 some alpha, and that gives you bound from the other side. Then you choose these according to the lemma, and so you get you get this, right, because these gamma l's can range over all the standard basis vectors and these EI plus or minus EJ things. X minus X0, this comes from G of X0 minus G of X. I've used it now with Y equal to X0 and you just estimate that. Okay, so again, you use concavity to get the estimate from the other side. Okay, finally, this part here. And now, this part is pretty easy. So let x and y be in omega, and let's suppose that 2d is equal to the distance of y to the boundary. And we've got two cases. Case one, if x minus y is, say, less than 2b squared, then d2u x minus d2u y. So the picture is like this. Y is here. This ball is relatively far from the boundary and x is here somewhere close. So we've got an estimate constant d to the alpha from here, using that estimate, times x minus y the alpha, and x minus y is less than 2d, so this whole business is less than constant x minus y alpha over 2. And the second case is if x minus y is bigger than, say, d squared or 2d squared, doesn't matter. You choose z on the boundary such that 2D is mod y minus z, or z, then so you just use the good old triangle inequality. Okay, so now each of these you get a constant, x minus z to the alpha plus y minus z to the alpha, using this estimate, right? One point's inside, one's on the boundary, z's on the boundary here. And now use the triangle inequality again, x minus y to the alpha plus y minus z to the alpha, less than constant x minus y to the alpha plus, this is d to the alpha, and all of this is less than constant x minus y to the alpha over 2, because again you've got this inequality, and that's it. So the only thing left to do is to give the proof of this lemma. Does anyone want to see it? Okay. Sorry? I don't know. Well, then you can read about it yourself. I basically explained it before. I can go through it. It's pretty short. We can finish for today. I'll go through. Okay. So first of all, proof of the lemma. So any symmetric matrix, positive symmetric matrix, can be written as A is sum k equals 1 up to some n prime, which I'll say gamma k, where n prime is n plus 1 over 2. Dimension of symmetric matrices, and gamma k in Rn linearly independent. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, any two matrices are similar. Any two positive definite symmetric matrices are similar, and that's because a positive definite symmetric matrix is similar to the identity matrix. Right? So similarity is obviously an equivalence relation, so that is clear. And now you look at this matrix A0, EI tensor EI, where I is less than J, so that's a positive definite. There's no factor out there. That's a positive definite matrix. In fact, if you work it out, it's a matrix that has n
down the diagonal, and ones everywhere else.
Okay, and so this matrix here has this form, as claimed, right? You get the right number of vectors if you add them up. And then in the general case, because they're similar, you just get, for a general matrix, you get this result simply by making a change of basis. So that's what basically what similarity of matrices does. You change the basis. Okay, so we've got that. Okay, now you look at part two, consider the family of sets, the U, depending on gamma 1 up to gamma n prime. So you take coefficient beta k, this, where beta k is bigger than 0. And, gamma 1 up to gamma n prime linearly independent. Okay, so that gives you, these are open sets. Right, because if a vector is in here, if it can be written in this way with some coefficients, then if you jiggle these gammas a little bit, they'll stay linearly independent. If you jiggle the coefficients a little bit, these things should be linearly independent. Okay. So if you jiggle these a little bit, they stay linearly independent. If you jiggle the coefficients a little bit, it still stays positive. So these are open sets. And this set S lambda capital lambda, well, this is a compact subset of SN cross N plus. So a finite number of these covers, right? And that gives you this collection, gives gamma 1 up to some large number gamma n. I set up here so you get a large number of these, but some fixed finite number. And therefore, any A in S lambda, capital lambda, can be written as A is beta k, gamma k, and the sum goes from 1 up to capital N,
and the beta k is positive,
not negative. Okay? Now, I want to get the beta k strictly bounded away from 0. So how do I do that?
Apply the above to A minus lambda star. Lambda star small, say lambda over 2 capital N.
Okay, so that's still a positive matrix, so it can be written in this way, and then you simply put that on the other side and you see you've got you can write it with a lower bound on the B case. Okay, finally, if you want to do the last thing, put in these EIJs, you do the same sort of thing here with the EI here, and you can you can simply include that in there. Okay.
Similar argument.
Yes. It can be decomposed in this way. Here?
Yeah.
Well, this is one particular one. Right, but yeah, for any given one, but the point is you want to do the whole collection. That's the point. Right? I mean, in general, if you're given just 2 positive definite symmetric matrices, you can't simultaneously diagonalize them. But this sort of does the trick for the whole infinite, a whole compact set of them, in effect.